Mike Pence on how to react to the Newtown massacre. Is he reading the situation properly? A new congressman's take on calls for gun control, the state revenue forecast and what it means for the tax cut debate, and the governor's final trip in RV1. That plus the Chrysler comeback, the Electoral College, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending December 21,
2012. Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. The path to a successful business has unexpected twists and turns. The legal professionals at Ice Miller are dedicated to guiding businesses along the journey. Experience takes businesses to the top. Ice Miller can help them stay there. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
This week, Governor-elect Mike Pence announced his selection for state police superintendent and at the same time staked out a position in opposition to new gun control measures. Former Hamilton County Sheriff Doug Carter will replace Paul Weitzel, who withdrew his name from consideration. At the announcement, the governor-elect was asked about his reaction to the massacre in Newtown, Connecticut. Pence said he will continue to defend gun rights.
This is not about access to guns. It's about access to schools. And I think we need to stay focused on making sure that our kids in school are secure.
Will there be an Indiana debate over gun control? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel, Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanes, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV State House reporter Jim Shella. Ann Delaney, do you expect the General Assembly to take up gun control?
Well, I think there'll be some proposals made. I mean, this was an opportunity, for example, for the governor to show real leadership, and he completely punted. I mean, nobody's talking about taking guns away from everybody, but the idea that assault weapons and magazines with 30 rounds in them are readily accessible is unacceptable anymore. You know, God willing, this would never happen in Indiana. But if it happens in Indiana, and we had an opportunity to do something about it in advance and didn't, I mean, I think there should be a national debate on this, not simply on gun control, but also on mental health issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got to deal with both of these things. And nobody's saying that the Second Amendment shouldn't be respected, but nowhere in the Constitution or the amendments are there references to assault weapons. There just aren't.
One of the things we've learned this week is that, according to Indiana law, teachers can be armed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
Does that make sense?
Well, I think it's general gun laws. It's not specifically about teachers that they have the right to take those weapons with them to their place of employment. And that's what it is. It's not teacher-specific legislation. But, no, I think there's going to be a debate on gun control. This was an unbelievably terrible tragedy. But I will agree with Ann that we've got to talk about everything that comes along with it. We've got to talk about mental health, access to schools. Governor-elect's right about that, even though Indiana is probably stronger than most states on that. But gun control will be part of that debate. I think there will be some things that are offered in this session of the legislature. Access to mental health care has got to be part of this mix, too. I mean, it goes on and on and on. It has to be talked about in its totality, and I think it will be, both at the national level and at the state level before it's over. But in this case, Connecticut has the fourth strongest gun control laws in America, and this guy, you know, it's hard to stop somebody who's mentally ill who's going to decide they're going to do something like this to go do this, and obviously they didn't there, and it's a terrible tragedy for this country.
Part of Mike Pence's argument is that Indiana has a law that requires trained school safety officers.
We do.
Something that many states don't have.
Right.
The only one.
According to...
He's also calling for a new security study in schools.
Well, right. Indiana, he says, is the only state that currently has that, takes that precaution, and I suppose that's wise. The sad thing is when he talks about... this isn't about an issue of access to guns, it's about access to schools. And this is just there's so many sad things about the past week or so, but one thing that has come out of this debate is we're treating schools now as fortresses. There was a time, probably not too long ago, when in a lot of towns in Indiana, the school was sort of the next best thing to the town square. That's where people would come and volunteer, and that's where grandma and grandpa would come in and watch the kids, or parents were encouraged to come in and volunteer. And I'm not saying that would end, but it just, it's a shame. As it was when we talked about similar sorts of security issues at the State House, when you have the People's House, and in many ways schools are, in many communities, a version of that, if you will. And it's just sad. And it, I guess it does raise the question, do you fortify then the schoolyard? Do you fortify the bus stop out in front of the school? Do you fortify the shopping center? Do you fortify, we could all drive around, I suppose, in armored vehicles with looking through the slits, but that's maybe not the way to live.
Well, is Mike Pence guarding against overreaction?
I'm not sure I quite understand that. I think that, you know, there is room for overreaction in this situation, and I do agree with John about this notion of a fortress in your school. I think safety is important, but I know that in a post-9/11 world, that's been on a lot of people's minds, and already schools are locked, but you know, you have to try to balance that. I think that we, in the last, since 9/11, have not really stopped to think about what we've given up in terms of rights and what our responsibilities are in terms of people who live in this country where we have these freedoms. And I think that, you know, the naive me, the Pollyanna me, thinks that this is really a good time to have the conversation about what we've done and what we should do and how we want to live as Americans and try to balance the safety with the freedom.
I think that's right, because the last thing we need to do is either teach the teachers to shoot or the bus drivers to shoot or make the schools a fortress. I think normal safety precautions, which are in place, make sense, but that school door was locked in Connecticut as well.
Yeah, he shot his way in there.
Yeah, and when you have an assault weapon like that, you can do that. And a training a person on safety is not going to stop that. And we have to ban that weapon. Was perfectly legal in Connecticut. It was perfectly legal in Connecticut, and it shouldn't be legal anywhere in this country.
Well, the Newtown tragedy will lead to action in Congress. That's the prediction of Congressman-elect Luke Messer. But the 6th District Republican says gun bans aren't the answer. While New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and others call for more gun control, Messer wants to see new comprehensive approaches to dealing with mental illness, and he says a ban on violent video games could help.
You know, I know some have called to try to use this as a way to call for gun bans. I don't support gun bans. I think it's the wrong approach. I do think there are other things that we may be able to do. We ought to look at a more comprehensive approach at mental health.
Mike McDaniel, does that make sense?
Look, I absolutely believe that he's right about what he's saying about taking a look at the mental health that we provide in this country, the services that we provide, and how we deal with those questions. Right now, we're in a society where we expect people to take some pills and it's going to take care of itself. And I think that's kind of naive, to say the least. And we've seen incident after incident where that's just not working. As far as the violent video games, I absolutely believe that there's an effect here of those games on our society. I mean, you know, for kids to come home after school and sit there in front of a television for hours and scoring points for how many people they kill on these games, I believe that there is a definite connection. But then you got to worry about First Amendment situations about freedom of communication. Pardon me?
Yeah. That pesky First Amendment.
No, but I'm serious.
We've
seen
Bart Peterson when he was mayor here.
Well, Tipper Gore. I mean, she was criticized when she brought up this idea of doing this kind of stuff back when. How long ago was that? I mean, this is a debate.
But Peterson tried unsuccessfully, and California passed a ban on violent video games, and the Supreme Court overturned it.
Yeah, and that's the problem. It's interesting how, with Luke Messer, the Second Amendment's an absolute, the First Amendment's up for grabs. It's kind of the way they seem to operate. I think all of it has to be on the table, and I think that the discussion, because of the First Amendment, has to come about with parents. And parents have to understand the connection between these things. So I am absolutely, I agree that it has to be a comprehensive, but that means that assault weapons aren't off the table either. And that's the approach these guys are taking. Let's talk about everything but the guns. banning those guns is not the only thing that we need to do, but it is certainly a big part of what we need to do.
Well, let me ask you, if you can take commercials off television for cigarettes, okay,
yeah,
why can't you take commercials off television where they're killing 50 people in 12 seconds on a commercial for
because
video?
You guys have appointed the Supreme
seriously.
Court.
It's the same thing.
You have appointed.
It's the same thing. They can do that.
You have appointed conservative Republicans to the Supreme Court who
those
won't
are,
do
those
that.
Those are John, public airwaves John. That are licensed by the FCC. Those are other issues. But when you're talking about
buying them,
you're buying them or you're playing them in your home. The irony or the odd thing I find here is people are so unwilling to ban the actual physical weapon, the gun that's going to fire those rounds into potentially into people. But if you have a digitized
virtual
game, that's somehow problematic. I think that's fundamental. I'm a First Amendment absolutist as much as others are a Second Amendment, Amendment absolutist. So I think anytime you start talking about bans, this is an issue for parents. I hate it when my kids, they spend too much time playing video games, but when they do that, it's my failing and my wife's failing. It's not, I'm not complaining to the manufacturer of the game or to some licensing agency.
Well, President Obama says that gun violence is a complex problem that needs a complex solution. Is there the mindset now that something can actually get done or not?
No. I'm convinced that Congress is not able to do this, and it really is unfortunate because it is a comprehensive and complex problem. Context is important. And I think that when we think about when the Second Amendment was adopted, and through much of the history of the United States, guns were a utilitarian tool, okay? They have evolved beyond that, and we have not. We haven't gotten as a society to a place where we recognize that you don't need bullets that explode on impact if you're a person who's out, just a regular person. You don't need a clip with 30 rounds in it. You don't need a semi-automatic that can easily be adapted to become a fully automatic weapon. We have not evolved as a society as much as the guns have evolved, and we need to make that evolution,
and
we haven't got the will to do it.
And the problem, the reason we can't as a society, much less in Congress or at the State House, have a legitimate debate is because there's so many boogeymen on both sides. There's so much false information and so many fear tactics that have been not only trotted out but embraced, again, on both sides, that you can't have an argument about, you know, those kinds of bullets that explode on impact or about 30 rounds versus.
Well, it's hard to argue right now that something.
Right,
not
but
a
I mean,
need
the,
for
you,
something
you,
to be.
But as soon as people hear that debate, they're obviously hearing somebody's going to come take my guns away
or need to get over that.
Majority of people in a Washington Post poll, even after this happened in Newtown, said that they're against a ban on handguns, for instance.
Okay.
A strong majority. And so. When the framers put this in the Constitution, this was about protecting yourself. It wasn't about the kind of weapons that were available.
But they were
at the
muskets. That took 30 seconds.
I understand that, but my point is,
Mike.
But the point is that it's about the right to protect yourself.
People
in this country,
but not with 30 magazines.
And I do worry. Your point's well taken because I do worry about context with the First Amendment. There weren't violent video games or the internet either. So your point's well taken.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific poll question in connection with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. Last week's question was, should the IHSAA have a mercy rule? 36% said yes, 64% said no. Due to the holidays, there will be a new question next week. To take part in the poll, just go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. An audit released this week listed two reasons why state government lost track of $526 million in corporate taxes: outdated technology and a work culture that sacrificed accuracy for speed are to blame. Auditors also found new errors. Three Department of Revenue officials quit their jobs in the wake of the discovery earlier this year. The new agency head says he's working to change the culture there. John Ketzenberger, is that the end of that?
Well, it will be if they are able to change the culture. And what's distressing is that it devolved to the point where $500 million is lost. I think that when you're talking about any amount of money in the public trust, you're talking about exactly that, the public trust. And if you can't account for that to the very penny, then you're breaching that trust, and that's what occurred. And so I think that, you know, I do think that they've got the right people in place, and I think that they'll be able to get it fixed, but they better, because they'll be hell to pay if they don't.
Yeah, one of the concerns expressed here by the audit was that there was not a comprehensive, uniform content management or processing system, in electronic or digital. Some things were done by hand. I imagine there's some sort of spreadsheet somebody with a green visor is still filling out the old-fashioned way. And so clearly there needs to be a fix there. The flip side of that, though, is if you have some supposedly foolproof system that no longer needs human intervention, I guarantee we're going to, in a few years, say it was, you know, we didn't make the mistake, it was this darn computer. And in fact, if we roll back the clock a few months, I think at the time it was all blamed on computers, not people.
No less embarrassing now than when it happened.
The Deloitte audit shows that it was systematic, and that combined with the culture, and those are things that are in the process of being changed, and will be changed. But I get a kick out of the fact that they lost this money because it was also found. There was never any money that actually was not eventually used or went to the proper sources.
It was unaccounted for in the budgeting process.
But it went to the communities that it was supposed to go to.
Go ahead.
Okay, that's all I have to say.
You know, the idea about the culture here, you take away the collective bargaining rights, you don't pay them very much, okay, and in some instances you even make fun of what they wear to work. I mean, you get what you pay for. There are people there that want to do the job and want to work, but they also want to feed their families and all, and you've got to take that all into consideration
the governor passed out
bonuses today for good service.
Yeah. Well, did they give them to the Department of Revenue, too?
For the people that did a good job, they probably did.
All right, we also got a revenue forecast this week that's pretty much where Mike Pence predicted it would be.
Right.
No change in the debate over whether or not there'll be a tax cut as a result of what's in the revenue forecast.
I don't think so. I think it's way too early.
Absolutely. There is a change in the debate, and from the standpoint that I'm hearing more people inside talking about, is this possible now than were before? And because he predicted his growth model was 2.5 per year for revenue, and it's 2.2 in the first year, 2.9 in the second. So when this falls within that, right. Now people are saying, well, this could be possible to do this and do the other things we're talking about with increases in education.
But there were also some very troubling trends in the revenue forecast. If you look at that, income tax, sales tax both went up, but everything else is predicted to go down. And if the economy doesn't take off, if we don't achieve that level of growth, it will be very difficult. We'll know more in April.
RV1, the campaign vehicle used by Mitch Daniels in 2004 and 2008, traveled from the State House to Elkhart this week. It will be on display for a year at the RV Hall of Fame.
The final ride in RV1 started after a brief ceremony outside the State House.
We took this thing on roads and to places it was never built to go to. It's a wonder it still rolls at all. But those were the best times, I think.
It fired up, right, when they put the new battery in.
Then it was on the road with the governor joined by Bill Osterly, his 2004 campaign manager, Eric Holcomb, his 2008 campaign manager, and the two guys who did most of the driving, Ben Leto and Adam Horst. Osterly is given credit for the idea to acquire an RV and to let supporters sign it inside and out. He says using it became a way to celebrate Indiana, and there were other benefits.
It was when he was in the office that he was miserable, and we were miserable. And so it worked out in this wonderful symbiotic. He was out on the road. He was happy. He was out on the road. We were happy.
A lot of vehicles make sort of cameo appearances now and then, but this thing was our everyday home.
John Schwanis, what do you make of the governor's victory lap?
Oh, hey, perfect way to wrap up and put a bow on what was a great idea from the outset. I mean, this reminds us why he was political director in the White House. He, in addition to being a governor, he is a shrewd political thinker. And to have something that is effectively a rolling billboard or rolling petition that is a symbol of what he represents, and that the government reaching out to the people, it's genius. It's great.
But he does a pretty good job of blowing his own horn, too. I mean, he gave a speech at the Rotary Club this week where he listed all of his accomplishments. He said that others are responsible. But.
You know, if you've had 8 years and you're a governor of a state, then you ought to take that victory lap. And if you don't, you're remiss for your own legacy.
You agree?
Oh, I agree. This was a great piece of political theater from the beginning to the end.
Absolutely.
He took a corporate insider millionaire from Indianapolis and converted him to a good old boy from they weren't sure where in Indiana he came from, with the flannel shirts and the motorcycle and the hat and stuff.
And did it in a way that really connected with people.
He was very, very good politics.
You know, spent the night, 125 nights in the homes of strangers.
He did. There's a punchline there, but I'm not going to talk about it.
I'm sure some of them were.
There is one mistake, though, he made. What? I'm guessing come next fall, he's going to wish that at those Purdue home football games and when the tailgate parties crank up, would that rock at a tailgate party? Or
no,
what?
Austerly's got a better buggy.
He's got a sweet. Don't worry about it. Yeah.
He's done a nice job here of
remaking himself.
He's done a great job.
Not giving up the spotlight.
You know what?
Not giving up the spotlight again, right?
This guy leaves after 8 years with almost 60% approval rating, one of the most popular governors in the state of Indiana, one of the most accomplished governors. He probably drove the political agenda in Indiana for the last decade more than any person ever has. And so he should be patting himself on the back on the way out.
Chrysler says it's working to add more than 1,300 jobs in central Indiana over the next few years. It hopes to invest $162 million in a new plant in Tipton County that could produce 850 jobs. And this week, Kokomo approved tax breaks for Chrysler. The company plans to invest as much as $200 million in new equipment there, adding more than 400 new jobs.
This is great news for our city, and I think it's great news for the entire state.
Well, Kokomo's been a long-standing partner with Chrysler. We have a great workforce here. And it's just a lot of experience, and for us, it's the right place to be.
Brian Harlow of Chrysler there, preceded by Kokomo Mayor Greg Goodnight Andolini. What's the moral in this story?
Oh, this is great for Indiana, absolutely great. And thank heaven for Richard Lugar and Joe Donnelly and Barack Obama. And thank heaven that Richard Murdoch didn't succeed, because the growth in Chrysler and the growth in the automotive industry in the state is benefiting us in a huge way.
This is looking like it's something better than what you maybe could have anticipated from the Chrysler bailout.
Oh, absolutely. This is great, especially for Tipton County.
Yeah, they've got that empty
850
plant
jobs. 850 jobs there. It's going to be absolutely huge. And Mayor Goodnight does a great job in Kokomo. He's done a good job of trying to make sure that they grow there. It's a great story.
He's a cousin of the president, you know.
I didn't know that.
He's a distant cousin of Barack Obama.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
But it's a great story, and the automotive industry in Indiana is flourishing, and there's a reason for that, and that's one legislature and Mitch Daniels and what he's done to put this state, in a situation where people want to grow here.
Well, it doesn't hurt.
Without the bailout,
but I think
they
the federal bailout
alive.
Is the key.
Federal bailout. And we've talked about this before. This was the automotive bailout played a much bigger role in not only the Senate campaign here in Indiana, but the presidential race. If you look at Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, other states, that may have been, if you had to point to one thing other than some of the gaffes of Barack Obama's opponent, I think the whole notion of the automotive bailout really made the big difference in the northern tier of states.
And if you're looking for examples of how the economy's turned around, Elkhart is one and Kokomo is the other. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's important to recognize, and that is really what's helping the state go forward. We're looking at sluggish growth, but we would be looking still at deficits were it not for the growth that we've experienced in central Indiana and in those two manufacturing areas that you talked about, because manufacturing is still the leading industry in Indiana and will be for the foreseeable future. Everything else spins off of that.
Plus, we're still getting a huge influx from Michigan and Illinois, where the climate is not as good, where companies are coming across the border to come to Indiana.
Although Michigan just adopted right to work. Yeah.
They're trying to catch up. And so is Illinois.
They're trying to lower the wages, just like Indiana.
When Studebaker reopens, we'll know we've got this thing won.
Right, finally. Mitt Romney's Indiana victory became official this week. The 11 members of the Electoral College from Indiana formally voted for Mitt Romney at the State House. Federal law requires that the nation's electors gather in December to cast their votes, which are then sealed and sent to the President of the U.S. Senate. The 11 electors from Indiana represent the 9 congressional districts and then 2 at-large electors who are representative of the 2 U.S. Senators, Mike McDaniel. How bittersweet is that?
Very much so. But this is a formal process and one that is a great honor to be a part of. I had that opportunity to do that, and it's a very humbling experience to know when you sign that name on there that's your actually having a making a difference in the history of the United States.
I found myself having to explain to people what was going on this week. They don't
You were the source.
But people don't understand the Electoral College.
No, they don't understand.
And they don't know that these people actually get together in December.
They want to know, how their basketball team is.
Yeah.
I have a question on that.
Yeah.
Did they have to show photo ID to cast
like you did at your convention?
Did they?
I don't know.
Like you did at the
National. It was a 2-hour ceremony.
You know, I think it is, you should have the pomp and circumstance surrounding that because it is a critical part of the process, and it's a shame that people don't fully understand what's going on.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/podcast, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Things can go wrong in 1,000 different ways. Businesses need a law firm that knows the 1,000 and first. The team of legal professionals at Ice Miller is committed to helping put the pieces back together. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.